Hey, it is great to be back at it this week, kicking off another fresh episode of The Far Middle. This one's the 175th installment. Wow. For our sports dedication this week, we're going to focus upon a subject individual, someone I've been meaning to highlight, it's been on my mind for some time on the podcast, perhaps the greatest at his specialty within his sport ever, and most likely the greatest of a dying breed, whose statistical records are not going to be seen again and whose presence will surely never be matched. Someone who combined his sports tradition, as odd and at times as brutal as that tradition might be, with creating an aura of added electric excitement when he did his thing. And in the end, also unfortunately a tragic, sad human story that became the subject of an autobiography and documentary titled Tough Guy. I'm talking about the sport of hockey, its culture of enforcers and fighting, and of the one and only Bob Probert. And if you had even a passing interest in hockey in the 1990s, and maybe you were like me with more than just a passing interest, Bob Probert, he was must-see TV. And if you saw him play in person, you watched him when he was on the ice as much as you did his superstar teammate, Steve Yzerman, who of course was a recent Far Middle dedication himself a few weeks back, if you recall, or even watching someone like Mario Lemieux, who I would have been watching when the Red Wings came to Pittsburgh. Probert was someone no one took their eyes off when he hit the ice. He was the closest thing the NHL had to a heavyweight champion, and he brought a Mike Tyson-like calm intimidation factor to boot. 16 NHL seasons, he ended up fighting in his career 232 times, to be exact, and that's according to HockeyFights.com, which is a website dedicated exactly to what its name infers, hockey fights. And Probert retired with 3,300 penalty minutes in total. One season, he fell 2 minutes shy of hitting 400 penalty minutes, which is no small feat. He was a crucial cog in the Red Wings' success, that wheel of success, as was the role of enforcer across many NHL teams back then. Just about every team had an enforcer. And as fighting continues to fade from the modern game, it's sort of tough to see how a new contender is going to emerge to take over Probert's all-time belt. He was the greatest, I believe, of a dying and perhaps already dead breed. And he earned enormous respect from his peers. At the beginning of his autobiography, Tough Guy, his teammate and legend Steve Yzerman had some words that he contributed. And by the way, Yzerman appropriately became a Red Wing 2 rounds before Probert did in the 1983 draft. They came in together. But Yzerman, in that foreword to the autobiography of Probert, he recalls the 1988 NHL All-Star Game. So you had the who's who of the league attending, of course, the All-Star Game. And he said, quote, "All the greats, like Wayne Gretzky and Mark Messier, were there. And the first thing they wanted to do was meet Proby. I remember them coming over and asking me, 'Can you introduce me to the big fella?' He was revered by players, and it wasn't just because he was a tough guy. It was because he was a great player." Now, in his essay, Get in the Ring, a celebration of the 1988-89 Detroit Red Wings, Sean McAdoo wrote, "In the late 1980s, there was still part of hockey's era of mutually assured destruction, when enforcers really did ride shotgun for superstars, instead of just vaguely threatening to from the bench. And Yzerman had the meanest bodyguard of them all, Bob Probert." I think that was well put. Now, a rival enforcer once said of Probert, "He was like a battleship cruising the ice, ready to take on all comers. Plenty of guys were just simply scared, you know what, of him." I'll leave that word out. No, but Probert was not just a goon. He actually was a talented hockey player. He could score 20 goals a year. He scored 29 goals the year that he amassed 398 penalty minutes. That year, he fell just shy of 400 penalty minutes with that mark. So think about that, almost 30 goals and almost 400 penalty minutes. But Probert, as I said at the outset, he was a tragic figure in the end. Addiction to alcohol and drugs killed him in the end. A bunch of legal trouble that came with those alcohol and drug problems, car and motorcycle accidents, DUIs, an arrest for cocaine possession, and a couple of rehab stints. And the cumulative damage, of course, done from all those fistfights. He drank his first beer at 14. He was dealing with alcoholism by age 17 during his first season in the junior hockey leagues. He said, "I could not have just one or two beers. If I did, I'd have 12. Now, what's really sad is how Probert paid the greatest price for the enforcer's lifestyle once he became a family man. He died at the age of 45, the father of four, a heart attack technically, but an examination of his brain revealed that he had suffered from severe CTE, which years of working as a professional bare knuckles brawler on the ice, that's going to result in that type of a diagnosis. And his addictions, I'm sure, did not help his heart either. I believe Bob Probert to be the greatest ever at what he did, the role of enforcer. That's a role that is now obsolete with today's game, but it's a role right out of the movie Gladiator. His life ended well before his time because of the price he paid in his profession. And if you want an example of what he was like in his element, go to YouTube and search Bob Probert and Marty McSorley. That fight sums up how Probert made his money. And if you watch closely toward the end of that fight, you'll note the code of honor between the two enforcers. And there was indeed a code. Now, Probert's most famous bouts, there's two of them in particular, were against one of his nemesis rivals. But that, constant listeners, is worthy of a future Far Metal dedication of its own. So for now, for episode 175, we honor Bob Probert, RIP. Bob Probert was a form of deterrence, in human form, on the hockey rink. The opposing team would not take liberties with the stars of the Red Wings because they knew there would be a consequence waiting for them in the form of Probert. And even if the other team had an enforcer, the best they could hope for would be mutually assured destruction. And that's where we're going to start our connections for the week. This episode sort of picks up from our episode last week where we discussed nuclear deterrence and Star Wars, or the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, and the need for SDI or an Iron Dome today more than ever because it's a very unstable world with multiple nuclear-capable adversaries out there opposing the United States and the West. I wanted to keep going last week and cover a related topic, but I ran out of time, so I want to cover it and pick it up this week. We have unfinished business, constant listeners. And the topic is the clearest experience that the Western world has had with nuclear deterrence real time. Back in the 1960s, fall of 1962 to be a little more exact, with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the unfolding of events, the process that American leadership employed to manage the crisis, in the day-by-day and hour-by-hour unfolding of tactical events, that sort of sequencing is just fascinating to look back upon. And with how well it worked back then to avoid nuclear war, but also how obsolete it might be potentially today with all the new crises that may be brewing. And better yet, we had a firsthand account of those events during October 1962's Cuban Missile Crisis because Robert F. Kennedy wrote a book about it that almost serves as a diary. He was in the room, so to speak. He was the brother of the president at the time. And he was also the United States Attorney General. And the book, of course, is titled 13 Days, and it tells us a lot about nuclear deterrence then, and I believe it informs us quite a bit about nuclear deterrence today. So let's take a closer look. The reason why this connection with those events in Cuba during October 1962 is not only the continuation of last week's episode, but is also of vital importance today, is because with multiple threats facing the West, China and Russia, and Iran and North Korea, decision-making in geopolitical crises that involves nuclear powers may need to become much more process-driven versus what I'd call individualistic, ego-driven. The Cuban Missile Crisis, I believe, will illustrate the point. Mid to late October 1962 was a time when the United States and the USSR were approaching the brink of nuclear war. And it's the only nuclear crisis that we have a detailed account provided by an insider, albeit it was from one person's and one side's perspective, granted. Again, that being Robert F. Kennedy. Now, the president, JFK, he manages the crisis from three competing velocities, as summarized by the great historian John Keegan. The velocity of Russian initiative, the velocity of American response, and the velocity of assessing and deciding a course of action. Now, I mentioned they were competing velocities, which meant they should be categorized separately and separated. Of course, velocity infers a rate of decision-making or a speed, because time was certainly of essence during those 13 days. So recognizing and organizing a process and subsequent decisions into different components, That's going to be crucial to managing a rational process during time of tension. Now, the president also decided to manage the crisis with a small group or inner circle, which he designated as the Executive Committee, or XCOM for short. Allowing this group to function when it came to trying to develop consensus for decision-making was a protection of sorts. He, the president, he wanted to make sure that the events outside of his control and their speed, or their velocity, so to speak, didn't unnecessarily speed up the rate of decision-making, which could have led to poor outcomes and consequences for all. The executive committee, the XCOM, did some quick math at the start of the crisis. They figured that deployment of Russian missiles in Cuba would take 2 weeks to complete. And they also determined that any American military decision would take only about 2 days. So simple subtraction told them they had about 12 days for their process to lead them to rational decision-making. So time was tight, but they had 12 days or so. And knowing how much time one has, that's vital to optimizing process decisions and the consequences. The executive committee saw three outcomes that were possible. There was a blockade option, bombing Cuba, or invading Cuba. And the committee did not organize itself, interestingly, into a hierarchy. Robert Kennedy pointed out that all members spoke as equals and that there was no rank, not even a chairman. Debates were unstructured and open. It created opportunity for individual members to participate heavily within, and it also created stressors for those who couldn't take the heat, so to speak. Dean Rusk, who was Secretary of State at the time, he was one such member who started to break under the stress. Bobby Kennedy thought that Rusk may have undergone a nervous breakdown early in the crisis, and he withdrew from subsequent discussions of the XCOM. Others were all over the board and inconsistent. McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, he would keep changing his position. He was for a first strike at the beginning, and then a blockade of Cuba later, and then for doing nothing. And then he reverted back to being a proponent of a first strike toward the end. But despite these challenges and the shortcomings of individual members of the executive committee, the structure and process successfully avoided groupthink. And groupthink could be a big problem in a crisis like the Cuban Missile Crisis. It took 3 days for the executive committee to reach perhaps not a consensus decision, but certainly a majority decision. And that was, of course, for a blockade of Cuba. A day was spent then on details, and then another day or two was invested for briefing and conferences with President Kennedy. 6 days in, out of the 12 or 13 days available, and the structure of the executive committee and its process, those things led to a rational response to the threat and an official approval of it from the president. And before you knew it, perhaps then it felt as if it took excruciating long. Within a week or so, the Russian ships carrying missiles turned away from Cuba and they headed home. What does Robert Kennedy's telling of the Cuban Missile Crisis story during those 13 stressful and historic days inform us when it comes to nuclear deterrence today? Well, go back to those three velocities that I mentioned, a la the historian Keegan: velocity of events, response, and decision making. How have those three speeds changed today compared to 1962? Well, the last one, the velocity of decision-making, hasn't changed much when it comes to how humans process information and make decisions. Although one can only wonder how technologies like artificial intelligence may accelerate that velocity to where decision-making is not only sped up, but may not be made by humans anymore. Instead, the biggest decisions in human history may now end up being delegated to an algorithm or a computer. Not human process, but coded process. So if the human mind hasn't changed its velocity of decision-making all that much since the Cuban Missile Crisis, while the technology is speeding up decision-making velocity on behalf of human beings, or at a minimum is creating an aura of being better informed, you can see where an increasing likelihood of escalation during crisis may occur, especially if the adversary thinks it has cracked the code of our algorithm. Plus, with multiple adversaries and threats, things are even more complicated, increasing both required pace of decisions and the risk of a misstep. Now, there are two ways to mitigate this reality and challenge. The first is to slow down those other two Keegan velocities of events and of response that in the end drive how much time the human has for decision-making during crisis. And that's where last week's discussion about Star Wars, or the SDI, and the need for it today more than ever comes into play. Now, whether SDI would work perfectly or not was, to a certain degree, irrelevant. Star Wars still has value, both politically and militarily, because even if Star Wars or an Iron Dome is not foolproof, and even if it's not perfect, it's still going to buy a significant amount of delay in a crisis. You're going to buy time. And it provides the human more time for rational thought and logical decision making. And time, once again, is everything during crisis. This is why there was so much debate back in the 1980s when it came to the wisdom of pursuing Star Wars. The conventional thinking was that Star Wars would upset the balance of mutually assured destruction, which brought deterrence. So back then, the thinking was mutually assured destruction was equivalent to deterrence. That was a good, necessary thing between two powers. And if the United States can shoot down missiles from its adversary suddenly, back then the Soviet Union, then that detente that resulted from mutually assured destruction, it gets broken, and now you have one nuclear power that believes it can actually win a nuclear war, thus increasing the chances of nuclear war. You lose nuclear deterrence, so the critics of Star Wars back then argued. Now, I don't believe that logic holds any longer, and I'm not sure it held even back in the 1980s, when it was just the United States and the West versus the USSR. But it certainly doesn't hold for today. Because, as I said, today the West faces multiple threats from more than one nuclear power. Not all of them think rationally or anything close to the way we think. An Iron Dome or Star Wars system today would bring two massive benefits in an unstable world. First, it would force those looking to escalate to think twice before doing so. Because escalation, worst case the firing of a nuclear weapon, would not only fail potentially to inflict harm because of a Star Wars or Iron Dome system, but it would also invite not mutually assured destruction, but assured destruction of the adversary, the nation looking to escalate. Star Wars creates ultimate deterrence this way. It's Bob Probert with no answer available by the opposition. But the even better benefit of such a missile defense system would be that it would buy time for decision-making in a crisis if deterrence failed. Now, that's not to say that there wouldn't be a horrific nuclear exchange. Because under this scenario, think of a first strike by an adversary, and then our missile defense system being somewhat effective but not completely effective, and the destruction of an American city or two that would result as some of the missiles get through our defense. But as horrible as that would be, it would still buy more time for the United States or the West to think through for what the next step or retaliation should be. And that will likely result in further terrible devastation, no doubt, this time to the adversary. Again, a tragic scenario by any measure, but it might be the best option we're faced with in modern war between nuclear powers, all of it premised on having precious additional time to make rational decisions, even though those decisions might result in nuclear death for millions of people. It's effectively the best outcome out of a horribly bad lot of options. And this is the world we're beginning to live in, sorry to say. Perhaps the best way of summarizing the benefit of a missile defense system like a Star Wars or an Iron Dome when it comes to nuclear threats is that it would replace the irrational actor with a hair trigger under intense time pressure deciding human events and replacing it instead with something superior, with the ability to think through things for a little bit longer in a way where hopefully the outcome is not mutually assured destruction. It's not a perfect outcome, but perhaps the optimal one for trying times like these. Which brings me to the second way to mitigate the risk of nuclear war in the modern age of geopolitical chaos. It may sound odd at first, but it is nevertheless effective. And that is to entrust our leadership and processes during times of geopolitical tensions to individuals who eschew the hero complex. What am I talking about? Cultures throughout history favored the individualistic hero. We covered Alexander the Great a few episodes back on the far middle, perhaps the penultimate example of hero leadership. Hitler would be an example of the evil side of the spectrum of hero leadership. And then there were countless others who fit the hero mold over the thousands of years between Alexander and today. Heroes tend to shoot from the hip, pun intended. to chart their own course and act off of instinct, emotion, and gut, to play to optics and think more about how the crisis can offer a historic opportunity for immortality. That's probably not what you want when it comes to modern geopolitical crises and potential nuclear war. Instead, you want in many ways a boring and sober leader, someone who's much more clinical and rational when they go about decision making, a person who strives for nothing more than the optimal outcome, even if that may prove to be politically unpopular or viewed negatively in the lens of history. I suppose what I'm saying is that we need today our heads of government to be true leaders, those willing to do what is best for their constituency or their nation, no matter what the cost to personal brand or historic reputation. That's why I always found Gorbachev to be fascinating, largely vilified by his fellow Soviets and Russians, yet perhaps charted a course that was optimal for the quality of life of his fellow citizens and their kids and grandkids. He didn't worry about being the hero or how popular sentiment may have run against him. He worried about being correct and choosing the optimal path out of the options on the game board. Now look around the globe and our adversaries today. Is Xi in China employing a hero approach to geopolitical decision-making, or is he looking like a rational leader? How about the president of Iran or the Ayatollahs who run things there? How about that kooky person as head of state of North Korea? And do you suppose Putin is taking the Gorbachev route, or does he consider himself more of a modern-day Peter the Great? I think we know the answers to those questions, and those answers are quite sobering, meaning our only hope for the United States and the West and the world, frankly, is to make sure that our side finds rational leaders applying effective processes and logic using the best available technologies to both defend from and defuse global conflicts that look to be rising by the day. We need rational leaders. We don't need another hero. I'm glad we were able to continue our discussion from last episode regarding nuclear deterrence in the modern age. I just mentioned how we don't need another hero. That creates an irresistible closing connection that brings together a futuristic film that was premised to take place in an apocalyptic world after a nuclear war, with a song title of We Don't Need Another Hero, a film that premiered when President Reagan was in office and pushing Star Wars or SDI. I'm talking about the Mad Max series of films from the late 1970s through the mid-1980s and Tina Turner's hit theme song to the film Beyond Thunderdome. I liked everything about this final connection. I think Mel Gibson, he's a great actor. I thought that the Mad Max films were outstanding and visionary for their time, and I've been a fan of just about anything Tina Turner put out during her career. And by the way, Tina Turner didn't just perform the hit single theme for the movie, but she also starred in the movie alongside Mel Gibson. Now, the accompanying music video for We Don't Need Another Hero, Thunderdome, remember that one? Features Tina Turner dressed in her Auntie Entity costume from the film, which was a heavy chainmail gown. It looked like that thing weighed a lot to walk around in. A futuristic nightgown, as night with a K. The music video received an MTV Video Music Award nomination for Best Female Video, and her song peaked at number 2 on the U.S. charts, was a Golden Globe nominee, and was also nominated for a Grammy. Not too bad. The lyrics at the start of that song sum up quite nicely what is at stake when it comes to getting our nuclear deterrence strategy and nuclear deterrence tactics right in today's world. So the opening lyrics of that song, out of the ruins, out from the wreckage, can't make the same mistake this time. Hear, hear. And until next week, stay connected to that far middle.